Welcome, everyone, to episode 356 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and we have a loaded show for you today. We're going to discuss the early takeaways from the Eastern Conference semifinals between the Celtics and Raptors and Bucks and Heat. And we are going to give our Game 7 predictions for Nuggets, Jazz, and Thunder Rockets. Before we get into all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. And we are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Joining me today is a guy who did not follow his own advice, Morten Jensen. How's it going?
That's rough. It's true, but it's still rough. No, I'm doing okay. I am definitely quarantining in my own bedroom, and the family is in the living room because I was at work this weekend, and apparently we got an email at work saying someone had been infected with COVID. So I'm taking all precautions now, even though I probably should have gone home over the weekend, but you know, work was work, and in a world where everyone seems to be getting fired, I unfortunately just let the pressure of actually having a job hit me and decided, yeah, I'm going to work. I don't want to risk anything. So, yeah, I'm here, and I'm getting tested on Thursday, and I'm a moron. Yeah.
Well, everyone, please keep your fingers crossed that Mort actually survives this ordeal. Because as much as I enjoy being told not to die at the end of every episode, I would actually enjoy to have that continue moving forward. So
that would be nice.
Fingers crossed for you, buddy.
Yeah. And just a heads up, apologies potentially for the sound quality. As I stated, I am quarantining in my home bedroom, so I am using a some sort of contraption here that's probably from the late 1700s to function. So yeah, I'm basically recording into a potato. We'll see how it works.
Yeah. So yeah, sorry in advance, but hopefully more will be out of quarantine by the next episode. So that's something to look forward to.
That would be nice. Or I'll be at the hospital. Either way.
Right. What are the, and then I'll just do solo podcasts, or I'll have to farm some guests out. So
that's true.
Yeah. Mort, let's start with the Eastern Conference semifinals, because we have now seen game one in both series. Let's start with Celtics Raptors, which was on Sunday and was shockingly uncompetitive for a series that we thought would be pretty close and evenly matched. The Celtics won 112-94. Pascal Siakam got into some early foul trouble, three fouls in the first quarter, which seemed to really throw him off. He finished with 13 points on 5 of 16 shooting. The Celtics just got well-rounded contributions, all five starters in double digits. Daniel Theis, 13 points, 15 rebounds. I mean, it was just a pretty emphatic beatdown in the Raptors. Were we wrong about this series? Like, do the Celtics just have a major schematic advantage over the Raptors, and it's not going to be as close as, you know, us and a lot of other people thought?
If they repeat that success in game two, yes. Otherwise, I'm just not ready to basically sum it up by one game. I'm just not the one game sample size type of guy, which is also why I hate the Super Bowl. Just for the record, I will say as much. Robert Williams contributing in the way that he did was so huge, and you brought up Daniel Theis as well. You know, that was 23 points and 20 rebounds and four blocks just combined for those two, and when you have that type of production from the center position, that just changes that gear from Boston. I feel like you know, Jason Tatum doesn't have to take 20 plus shots or have to be involved in the offense constantly. The same can be said for Kemba. Same can be said for Jaylen Brown. You can sort of pick and choose your spots, because then you'll have some reliable production, some capacity from your big men. And that's very necessary. Like, we came into this year and we're looking at the depth and we're going, who can they actually play off the bench? And some of that holds true. I mean, 28 very unproductive minutes for Brad Wanamaker. Semi Ojeleye played 23 minutes, wasn't really that noteworthy. Defensively, he had some pretty good moments, but offensively, Jesus, that was just putrid. Mm-hmm. So it's really Robert Williams. So if he can become that six-man type of scorer on the interior and a defender, I think that changes the flow of the series. Now, does it swing it all the way in Boston's favor? I don't know. But that was a beatdown, and we'd have to take note of that moving forward.
Yeah. From the Raptors' side of things, are there any major adjustments that you'd like to see Nick Nurse make heading into game two, or do you just think this is like, Pascal getting in early foul trouble, like Fred VanVleet probably isn't shooting 3 of 16 again from the field? Can they just chalk it up to like, this was a weird game and we expect to play better?
A little bit of that, but I will say as much. VanVleet took some shots that I certainly didn't agree with. I think there were times when he was looking at the score a little bit too much, and he was trying to force things that he maybe shouldn't have. There were definitely a couple of threes where I was like, oh, that's very early, that's very long, you probably could have gotten a better shot. So I would want the Raptors to play with a little bit more patience in game two. It seems like they were a little bit, panicking very early on, I think. And then Serge Ibaka's defense. I've been so complimentary of Ibaka's defense all year. That was Sunday. That wasn't really good. I mean, he got stuck a lot and couldn't keep up with the perimeter guys on switches, and he kind of was flat-footed a lot. So I think it needs to just be one of those comeback games where everything needs to click.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both as well. I mean, I don't think the Raptors will play as poorly in game one as I expect them to in game two. They were trying to do some Pascal post-ups, and I don't think that's necessarily an advantageous matchup. I know he's got a height advantage over Jaylen Brown, but like Jaylen Brown is really strong. I would not necessarily be trying to force the issue there. I think they need to be more creative in the way they... I mean, Pascal was tied for the team lead in shot attempts with 16 with VanVleet. That's fine. I just think they need to diversify how he's getting his shots. You know, like the Boston proved in round one against Philly. They defend post-ups very well. That is one thing. I know you think you have a size advantage over them, but they have schemed their way out of it time and again. So I wouldn't be trying to force the issue there. And I mean, we talked about this heading into game one. Like, they have, with the Hayward injury hurts them offensively, and they're top heavy, it deprives them of one of their six really reliable guys. But what it does is bring Marcus Smart into the starting lineup, and now you have Smart, Tatum, and Brown. That's very tough defensively. So,
and Tice.
I can get hunting the matchup with Tice because of the size advantage, but really I think you gotta hunt Kemba. Kemba's gonna be the head of that snake offensively, so you better make him work on defense. So whoever he's guarding on any given possession, whether it's Lowry or VanVleet, I think that's, you just need to go like relentlessly go after that instead of forcing the issue. Like, Marcus Smart is too good. He's too good of a defender to really be challenging him all the time. Like in the NFL, when there's a star cornerback, you throw to the other side of the field. Like, you just don't challenge that guy. And they have that.
Yeah, totally.
Marcus Smart is that type of player. So, you have two guys in Lowry and VanVleet who can really run the offense and can somewhat work interchangeably in that sense. Whichever one of them is not on Smart in a given possession is on Kemba. That's I think, the matchup you attack if you're the Raptors. Mm.
Totally agree on that NFL reference, Brian. Yeah, completely. but to your point, honestly, you brought up like Pascal Siakam's post up. There's really only one guy or two guys of the Celtics players who got consistent minutes in game one that I would want to see Siakam post up. That's Kemba Walker and Brad Wanamaker. Literally everyone else, like Ochile, can keep him from the basket because he's basically as strong as the entire building that I live in. Robert Williams is there, Tice, Brown, Tatum is also smart defensively. Marcus and smart, even though he's like 6'4", 6'3". I just don't want to do it. Like, this is a guy who wants to lock down Paul Millsap. Like he's going to be afraid of Pascal Siakam in the post? No way. this is going to be a really an inside or an outside oriented offense for Toronto moving forward in this series. And whatever you can get in the paint is basically a bonus, I think, because this is just one hell of a defensive unit. So I agree with you. They should target Kemba. They should target Brad Wanamaker when he's in the game. And he's actually a pretty stable, reliable defender as well. He's not bad, but if you can get a mismatch on him, just go ahead. And I would also trust, you know, Van Vliet and Kyle to do some damage when he's on the court. But I mean, the Celtics are just rotating and they're calling out things and they're playing smart. I mean, and not just Marcus Smart, everyone's playing smart. I really appreciated watching that. It was a great like basketball game, if you catch my drift. Like not necessarily one of those, you know, 154 type of games, but it was fundamentally sound. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the challenge for Nick Nurse and the Raptors is whether they can execute in the half court offense against Boston. That was one of the concerns going into the series.
Right.
Especially, you know, when they get down 39-23 in the first quarter and it's just kind of trying to dig your way out of that afterward. Like, that concern is not answered at this point. I mean, that's the big question heading into game two is how do you pick them apart in the half court? So I don't have a great answer to that question because they don't have that star wing scorer. Like, Kawhi Leonard was their answer last year. I mean, that's the problem. They don't have that guy, whereas the Celtics do have a Jason Tatum. And, you know, maybe it's simplistic, but, like, maybe that's the difference in this series. I think we're seeing throughout the playoffs, like, the value of star wing scorers who can generate their own offense in the half court, whether it's Tatum, Jimmy Butler, who we'll get to in a second. Kawhi has just been an assassin. Like, I mean, without Kawhi Leonard, the Clippers lose that series against the Mavericks.
Oh, for sure. And
so, I mean, you know, the Raptors survived as long as they did without Kawhi during the regular season because they are super well coached and they have the chemistry despite losing Kawhi and Danny Green. But, like, now this is where that work really shows up when you're going against a team with that archetype of player. So, I mean, that is the challenge for Nick Nurse heading into game two. It's like, your defense is great. I think they'll bounce back in that regard. But they scored 94 points in game one. Like, they have to keep up offensively, and they got to figure out ways to manufacture baskets.
Well, I mean, not shooting 10 of 40 from downtown might help.
Right. That would certainly make a difference, yes. I'm intrigued. I mean, I don't think this series is going to be a blowout. I expect game two to be closer, but, I mean, I hope it's closer because I don't want this series. Like, I wanted this series to go 6 or 7. I think it could be a really fun chess match, you know, between two great teams and two great coaches. So
yeah.
I'm excited to see what Nurse cooks up for game two.
But at the same time, if Boston just completely annihilates Toronto in this series, that would actually add a pretty interesting subplot as well in terms of how serious should we take Boston going into the conference finals, because whoever wins that other series, Milwaukee-Miami, they're going to be waiting on the other end, and that's going to be a bloodbath. Well, because they're going to be rested if they get through this quickly.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's get into Miami and Milwaukee now, because game one was Monday night. I was shocked at how many people were picking the Heat in this series. Like, it seemed like almost a 50-50 split from what I was seeing on Twitter and, like, you know, ESPN predictions. I think slightly favored the Bucks, but, you know, I expected it to be, like, pretty lopsided toward them. And, you know, the Heat come out Monday night and make everyone look really smart. Jimmy Butler drops a 40-piece. Bam Adebayo, 12 points, 17 rebounds, 6 assists. Giannis only has 18 points, 10 rebounds, 9 assists. Chris Middleton had a pretty good game with 28 points. Brooke Lopez was great, 24 points on 8 of 10 shooting. Eric Bledsoe did not play in this game, which is worth noting because his absence, I think, did loom large, but Mort, how worried are you if you're a Bucks fan heading into game two of this series?
I'm slightly worried because I don't think the Bucks have played all that well in the bubble whatsoever. And I think Giannis has begun showing some sense of being a little bit too, what's the word? A little bit too predictable in a way. I think that might be unfair, but you kind of still know a little bit what's coming, right? He's gonna start his dribble up high. He's gonna gain speed, and he's either gonna make like one of the spin moves, or he's just gonna crash straight into a wall. There isn't that refinement anymore. And now that he doesn't make any three throws, now it really doesn't matter if you put him on the line. That has really been one of the things that we have not talked about enough, is just how big of an issue it's been for the Bucks that Giannis doesn't make free throws anymore. Like, this was a guy who, let me just look it up. I think he had a year somewhat recently even where he hit like 77%, right? Like, he was up there almost 80. Yeah.
And he was, yeah, down in the 60s this year. He was 4 of 12 in game one.
Right. This is a major, major drop off. And all of a sudden, this is really a statistical anomaly if you consider like the last couple of seasons. And this is eight points that he's leaving on the line. I mean, in what, an 11-point game? That's pretty substantial. At some point, if you have a defense that knows, look, it doesn't matter if we foul him. It really doesn't matter because we'll live with the percentages. Okay, that changes your entire offensive strategy if you're Milwaukee, yet that's one of the plays they keep going to. I don't know what they need to adjust. I really don't. I kind of want to see Giannis just be a little bit more of a five-ish man and just like a rim roller and do all the center stuff instead of being, you know, much of a ball handler. I don't think he should be concerned about the assist this series, is what I'm saying. He should basically go out there and say, I'm going to score from 7 feet and in, and I'm going to try to get 45 every single game. I think that has to be one of the responses.
Yeah, and I think that is in part where they missed Bledsoe. They, you know, they had George Hill moving in the starting lineup. He can be a table setter for that starting group. But, you know, I think ideally you have George Hill coming off the bench where he can serve in that role in the second unit. Bledsoe can be that secondary ball handler with the starting group. And, you know, also, of course, you're missing Eric Bledsoe's defense, particularly against a guy like Goran Dragic, who has 27 points on 9 of 15 shooting. So,
right.
I mean, I don't want to overreact. It's one game. But, you know, if you're looking at it from a Heat perspective, like, Duncan Robinson only had 4 points on 1 of 4 shooting from deep. I mean, that doesn't seem sustained. Like, he's going to have one game where he hits, like, 5 or 6 threes and probably swings that game.
Right.
So, I mean, like, if you're a Heat fan right now, you must be feeling great. And I think, you know, this was the topic du jour on Twitter last night, unfortunately, Mike Budenholzer. And, you know, the coaching matchup, we're talking about, you know, Boston and Toronto being a matchup of two great coaches in Brad Stevens and Nick Nurse. This one, it seems like there's a pretty sizable mismatch between Eric Spoelstra and Mike Budenholzer. I know his Bud's rotations came under fire last night, and then there was a question, someone asked the question to Giannis after the game, you know, like, was there any consideration to switching onto Jimmy late? Because, like, Jimmy was just absolutely cooking them in the fourth quarter.
Right.
And, you know, Giannis brushed it off. He's like, no, why would you even ask that? I'm just going to do what coach says.
Right.
Which I don't know if he meant it as shade, but it could at least be interpreted that way.
Is Giannis the shade type of guy, though?
I don't think so. Like, I think it was innocent.
Yeah.
Like, if Joel Embiid said that, he knows what he's saying.
Right.
But, like, I don't think Giannis meant it like that, but at the same time, it makes Bud look bad.
Right. I hear what you're saying. Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think that, like, how worried should we be about Budenholzer in particular?
I mean, now we're getting to that point. Remember, we had this conversation a couple episodes back where I was just not ready to pull the whole plug on the, you know, the Budenholzer thing, because I was just tired of the criticism. You know, he was in Atlanta before. Last year was his first year with Milwaukee. You know, now's the time. Now's the time for him to prove to everyone that, yeah, last year was just me getting acclimated. And, you know, before that, that was Atlanta. Atlanta. It's just not, we didn't have Giannis Antetokounmpo in Atlanta. Like, you can't make that comparison. So now that he has this roster, most of whom, you know, are in their primes, now's the time to prove it. And if he can't, I don't know what, you know, the Bucks are going to do about it. I'm not there where if they're getting bounced, you're going to go, oh, he should be fired. Because, like, who's out there that's drastically better? I don't know if that coach is out there whatsoever. So that let's table that discussion for later. But it's certainly one of those discussions that needs to be had in terms of what can Butt do to optimize the current talent on his roster, and in particular Giannis. Now, I think he did a good job just with Chris Middleton getting him back, because he had a putrid series in round one. So for him to actually get flowing like this again is pretty good. One note I will say, Brook Lopez has had some pretty big offensive games in the bubble. Like, he's had some games where you're like, why are you not just taking more shots generally? He was a guy who was averaging 20 plus points for the Nets for years, and he's kind of scaled back and become this third or fourth option, like relying more on the three and being this complimentary scorer, which is fine in the regular season, but right now in the playoffs when they need it, I kind of think you gotta go back to Brook just a little bit more. I'm not saying he should start taking 20 shots a game, but I would have no problem seeing him scale that up to about 12 or 15 shots per game. I think he's that capable because he can score inside, he can score outside. He's got a pretty good mid-range shot as well. And if he establishes himself inside and he gets fouled a lot, he can hit free throws, unlike Giannis. So it's one of those give and takes, right? Because then if he's in there, what do you do with Giannis? Like, if Brook needs to establish himself inside, there's not going to be the space necessary for Giannis to do so as well, because then you're basically playing 90s basketball. So maybe you just stagger them. I don't know, but I would like to see Brook more involved. The 24 points was a nice touch. The one rebound, however, oh boy, that's a no more of that, Brook, please.
That's the full Brook Lopez experience right there.
It really is. Oh my god, it really is. Like, the Bucks. Here's a fun fact: the Bucks had 34 rebounds. So basically, Bam Adebayo, one player, had half of what the Bucks had as a team.
Yep. Yeah, Bam was fantastic. And yeah. I mean, he's gonna have the majority share of defending Giannis in this series. You know, Crowder, Iguodala, Butler will switch on to him at times, but that's gonna be Bam's primary matchup. And, you know, round one went to Bam.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think they could do? I mean, they have to figure it out and answer to Jimmy Butler. 40 points on 13 of 20 shooting, 12 of 13 from the line, hit two big threes late. Middleton seemed to not be able to guard him one-on-one.
Right.
Do you switch Giannis onto him? Like, do I dare ask that question?
I think so, yeah. That would be obvious. He's got the reach that Jimmy doesn't have. Jimmy's still got a little bit of T-Rex arm in him, and that is also a factor offensively. We have this tendency as a basketball community to always talk about length defensively, but offensively it's the same thing. Like, that's still relevant, because when you go up for a layup, if you have longer arms, you can finish higher up near the basket. That's just, like, look at Giannis. Giannis is the perfect example. He can, you know, when he goes for a drive, he basically dunks what everyone else puts up as a layup or a push shot. Like, he dunks that because he's long. Jimmy is not long. So for him to put the ball on the floor, you kind of want to match him up with someone with length that can really challenge his looks. So yeah, I would definitely go that route. And not just to shut him down as an offensive player, but also just take away his passing. You know, Jimmy is a fantastic passer. I know he only had two assists, but that's because he had his offensive game flowing. Like, you know, we've seen that from great players throughout the course of history. Like, they can be some of the best passers ever. Yet if they got it flowing offensively, they'd be like, nope, I'm gonna take this. And he had 20 shot attempts and 13 free throw attempts, which is the aggressiveness I want to see from Jimmy every single game. I love this version of Jimmy. I think you have to make that adjustment because he straight up cooked Middleton defensively. I don't know if it was a speed advantage or if it was the fact that Jimmy is a little bit more slithery. We love Chris Middleton, honestly, but he's not as fluid as Jimmy is. So I think it's a little bit tougher on him to chase Jimmy around, who's very creative both on the ball and his movement pattern.
Yeah, I mean, Jimmy actively seeks out contact, so he's not going to shy away. Like, he's going to bulldoze his way to the rim and force teams to either foul him or let him get the open shot. So I guess that's the one concern from Milwaukee's perspective about putting Giannis on Butler. Like, Jimmy will just attack Giannis, I think, even despite the size mismatch. Like, he knows if he gets Giannis into foul trouble, that's game over for the Bucks.
So yeah, but is that one thing you can rely on? I mean, we're talking about the defensive player of the year after all.
Right. So, I mean, if I'm the Bucks, I'm not necessarily, like, coaching in fear of that. I think you need to have an adjustment ready in case Giannis does pick up two early fouls.
Right.
And I'm not saying you have to keep Giannis on Butler the entire game. I think the Bucks need to treat Butler like he's LeBron James at this point. Like, treat him, send so many different waves of defenders at him that he just can't figure out where it's coming from or, like, who's his primary matchup on a possession-by-possession basis. Another thing is, I mean, I know he's hit, you know, he went 2 of 2 from three-point range last night. He hit some big ones in the first round against Indiana as well. But, you know, that three-point shot went MIA, no pun intended, for most of the regular season.
Yeah.
Dare him to shoot from deep.
Yeah.
Like, you know, crowd the paint and dare him to shoot. Because if you're guarding him close on the three-point line, as you said, he's really slithery, really fluid. He will drive and he will get into the paint. And then, again, like, either get someone in foul trouble or whatever. Crowd the paint. Cut off his driving lanes. Dare him to shoot. Especially if you're Giannis and you have that size advantage over him where you can close out quickly because you have go-go gadget arms. I think that's the most logical adjustment that I'd like to see from Milwaukee in Game 2. Now the question is, does Budenholzer arrive at that same conclusion, and does he... You know, does he make such a substantial adjustment after only one game, or does he trust his scheme to get them back into it? Just, like, trust that Jimmy Butler's not going to go out for 40 again?
You know, it's a funny thing, you know, the whole idea of trusting your scheme. I think that's why Nick Nurse is such a great coach. He doesn't really have a scheme per se. Like, he's ready to mix everything up and just go crazy if something, like, dictates it. And I wonder if that's what you do. Like, maybe you read the room a little bit more and you go, okay, that didn't work. Let me just do something completely different for this time around to throw everyone else off. Sometimes chaos is your best friend in the playoffs. And yeah. Jimmy, but here's the thing though. Jimmy is basically the master of chaos. Like, he can operate in that. He used to play for the Bulls. He knows chaos. I mean... This shouldn't even be a contest. I don't know. I have a feeling that, am I off in saying that if the Bucks make it to the finals, Jimmy Butler might actually be the most difficult player they would have met on their path towards the finals?
Because otherwise it would be Tatum or Kemba.
Tatum, Kemba, no one on the Magic.
Siakam, maybe, or Kyle Lowry. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think Tatum will surpass Jimmy at some point, but I don't think he's quite there yet.
Right, exactly. That's kind of my point. Just this year, I think Jimmy is a huge test. Because, I mean, you and I agree, Jimmy is a superstar right now. Like, he is playing like a tier one, level one superstar. And it's not just the 40 points. Even in the games where he's like 18, 19, he's giving you the defense. He's giving you the playmaking. Right. He's giving you the rebounding, the low turnovers. Like, he's just, He's everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we said it last segment, like having a player like this right now, I mean, you know, this is a 16-game player. You're not going to get this version of Jimmy Butler in the regular season often, if ever. But when he can turn it on like this in the playoffs, this is why you give him a max contract. This is why you want him in your organization.
You know, it's okay, Brian. You can cry. You can cry.
No,
it's okay.
I mean, like, there's a reason Joel Embiid was subtweeting the Sixers front office as aggressively as he was.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, they spent the entire offseason reshaping their roster to beat the Milwaukee Bucks. They got swept in the first round. The Heat were 1-0, up 1-0 on those Milwaukee Bucks in the second round. It's because of Jimmy Butler.
Like, you do realize
they had it in their hand and they just pissed it away, which is hilarious.
You do realize that you and I are both lovers scorn when it comes to Jimmy, right? He left us both.
I don't blame Jimmy Butler at all for getting out of the Sixers when he still can. And I think he made the right choice, and I would not be surprised to see Joel Embiid join him in a year.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that so much.
We'll table that.
Yeah, but I would love a JoJo Jimmy reunion. That would almost be like Toby and Bobby. I mean, that would be, just get them all back together. Think about the six. Look, the Sixers had the double duo at the same time. How can you not keep that around? You had Toby and Bobby, and you had JoJo and Jimmy. Come on, come on.
I know. Well, I'm writing something for Forbes that will make me persona non grata on Sixers Twitter, so keep an eye out for that in the coming days.
Well, look, on the bright side, at least it seems like you might be hiring Jason Kidd, so you've got that. You've got that going for you, which is nice.
All that report was him expressing his interest in the job. The fact that it wasn't even like the Sixers were considering him, it's just that, like, hey, I want this job. That makes me feel slightly better, although I'm still high alert about this coaching search.
Look, there's plenty of room on the Mavs wagon. I'm telling you, it's still wide open. Come join us. Giannis is going to join us in 2021. So come on, just join the party.
He very well might. Or, I mean, look, the Heat have been clamoring for Giannis this whole time. If they send him home in this series, that's going to have Milwaukee very nervous about the future.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I still think it's Dallas that everyone should be afraid of, and I will have a piece up on Forbes about that maybe in a week or so.
Well, Zach Lowe even mentioned it, I think, today or yesterday in a piece.
I know, it worked. My year-long campaign have worked. It's reached the desk of Zach Lowe. Probably not my, probably not due to me, but I still felt validated. It doesn't make sense, but I still did. That's nice.
All right, well, let's pivot to the West now, Mort, because
can we just get one thing straight just before we do, because I want to get this out of the way. Brandon Ingram was drafted second overall. If we are going to play these games where it's okay to give a guy who's drafted second overall MIP, you know what? Then Luka Doncic should have won it. I don't care who you are. If that's the logic you go after, you give it to Luka.
I don't necessarily disagree.
Good.
I mean, I think in our postseason awards pod, I picked Devontae Graham just because he was so like 0-60, whereas all of these other guys were like good to great or great to superstar,
right? Like 30-60,
yeah, right. Or in Luka's case, like 55-80,
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the writing was on the wall for Ingram, just because he did take. You know, you can't deny he took a big step forward this year.
No, of course not.
I think a lot of guys did. I think this was just a really hard race to parse where there wasn't necessarily one clear-cut candidate, because you could really make a case for, I mean, at least like four or five guys.
Yeah, but you don't go with the guy who's drafted second overall. This was expected. It's to some extent, and he got better last year as well. Like the year he took, yeah. the leap yeah. he took from last, or the 2 years ago to last year, was also somewhat substantial. I agree with you that he went from being, you know, starter to all-star, and that's significant. But Luka Doncic went from, you know, yeah, a snubbed all-star, because he should have been in the first year, to an MVP candidate. So, again, I'm against that whole, you know, giving the top draft picks MIP awards. But since the NBA apparently doesn't care one iota what I say, I'm just going to say, then Luka should have won it. And I'm very upset. Screw the MIP award.
I mean, it does go back to your idea of there needs to be clear-cut criteria for all of these awards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it should... Should you take draft positioning into account?
Yes.
And I mean, in Ingram's case, I agree. I will say this. You know, I saw Markel Fultz got a couple MIP votes, and I don't think he had a good enough case over any of the guys who finished ahead of him.
Right.
But, like, if a guy like Markel Fultz turns into an all-star next year, I don't care that he went number one overall. He had such a weird start to his career that I would have no problem with him winning MIP. But Ingram, I mean, there was never like a, you know, forgot how to shoot, average 4 points a game, played 20 games for over two seasons, and then became an all-star. It was like, yeah, he averaged like 15 points on low efficiency, then 17 on low efficiency, and then kind of just worked his way up gradually. So I'm with you. I think Graham had a better case. I think Bam Adebayo had a better case. I think Luka had a better case. But I think all of them are just like, split the award in five. I don't care. And like, how do you choose between them this year? I really don't know.
But to your point, you know, about Markel Fultz, that's interesting because that could be part of the criteria. The part of the criteria could be the narrative. Like, I would have no problem with that. As long as there is a set criteria, this is not the Wild Wild West. Oh, well, okay, hang on. I just watched the news about an hour ago about the States. So maybe it is. Never mind.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. That's fair. All right. Well, let's now pivot into the Western Conference playoffs because we have two Game 7s on tap tonight. We have Nuggets Jazz. Tomorrow we have Rockets Thunder. So let's start with tonight's game, Mort. The Jazz were up 3-1 in this series. It seemed like it was all but over. The Nuggets win Game 5, and then Gary Harris makes a surprise appearance in Game 6. Doesn't do much as a scorer, only 4 points on 1-of-4 shooting, but plays 21 minutes. But of course, I mean, the big story really of this entire series has been Jamal Murray versus Donovan Mitchell. I mean, again, an incredible showdown between these two guys, just absolutely ridiculous shot making for both of them the whole series. But Jamal Murray in the past few games, I mean, 17 of 24 shooting, 9 of 12 from 3, has a 50 burger, and the Nuggets win 119-107. So, more is Game 7, like, is it reductive to say it's who wins the Jamal Murray versus Donovan Mitchell battle?
No, that's not fair. But before I continue, I just want to read you a stat. This is insane. We agree that so far in this series, we've seen 6 games be played, right?
Yes, that is a fact. Correct.
I just wanted to make sure everyone is following along. So combined, Jamal Murray and Donovan Mitchell has combined for 62 made threes. That means that on average, the two combined to make over 10 threes per game over the course of the series.
Yeah, that sounds right.
That is insane, man. That is just utterly insane. Has this been the most entertaining, like, one-on-one series we've ever seen before?
Yeah, I mean, I saw people on Twitter, like, asking, is this the best one-on-one showdown? And the only other one people could come up with was Allen Iverson versus Vince Carter in 2001.
Oh, that was epic as well. But I yeah. almost think that depending on how this one ends here in Game 7 and how they play respectively, this might top it. Right?
I mean, we'll see what happens in this right. one, but you know, so far it's been at, like, this is a legendary series already.
Right.
And it's, I mean, in large part because of these two guys, but you know, I think I don't remember the exact stat, but I think there was only four guys in NBA history or four or five guys in NBA history who had two 50-point games in the same playoff series. And I think it was MJ, Iverson, and then now Donovan Mitchell and Jamal Murray, both yep. of which are in this series.
That's insane. Let's just say people like scoring in the bubble. It's going well for them. Like, the Jazz have a true yeah. shooting percentage of 64 in this series.
Oh, it's outrageous. God.
That's outrageous. Okay, your question was, like, who would be better or who would be considered best, whether to be the winner. I can't get aboard that line of thought. I just don't think it's right. These teams are so evenly matched that if someone, you know, gets by a hair, it's just that player won. He's got bragging rights for sure, but that's not going to dictate how I view that specific player. If anything, you know, my opinion of both these guys has just risen tremendously over the past mm-hmm. week and a half, and that's not going to change whatsoever. Like, one guy could score 60 tonight and the other could go to, you know, lay a donut or lay an egg, wouldn't bother me whatsoever.
Yeah, let's hope that isn't the case.
Oh, yeah. Both should get 60.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, Jamal Murray in games 2 and 3, 14 points game 2, 12 points in game 3, and they got smacked in both games. Like, they've needed this version of Jamal Murray to have the success that they've had. But, you know, over the last three games, he's averaging 47.3 points on 64.2% shooting, 62.9% from deep on 11.7 attempts per game, 8 rebounds, 7 assists in 42.5 minutes. Like, this is the Jamal Murray that they gave $170 million to.
Right.
Or this was 158, whatever it ends up being.
Right. This is what they were waiting for. And we, you know, friend of the podcast, TJ McBride, has told us repeatedly on the podcast as well that they were ready to not see that contract pay off for a year, maybe two, after it activated. So mm-hmm. for them to get this type of you know, play for him now, this is a win. This is a clear-cut win for the Nuggets. I have a feeling that Tim Connelly has slept very, very well these past 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And I wrote a piece about Nuggets for Forbes recently, basically detailing that, you know, the ceiling now for Denver is exponentially higher because it's not just Jamal Murray. We now know that Michael Porter is not some empty calorie player. Well, defensively, he's horrible, but that needs to be pieced together. But offensively, there's a player in there. Yeah, he hasn't mm-hmm. been as efficient in the playoffs, but again, it's the playoffs. It's a different beast. He's still producing at a level where you can look at it and go, he's going to be a factor moving forward. He's going to be a significant offensive factor moving forward. Now, remember, coming into the playoffs, the only really known commodity was Nikola Jokic. You didn't know what you were getting with Gary Harris because of all the injuries. Will Barton was in and out of the lineup. Jamal Murray was inconsistent. You really didn't know what type of player would turn up. Jeremy Grant was reliable, but he's not one of their main offensive guys. So there's a lot of question marks. Like, Paul Millsap, he's 77 years old. What can we rely on him? No, maybe not. For the Nuggets to have Jamal Murray now become, I have to assume, like, the team's leading scorer from here on out. I mean, I would be shocked if he wasn't, because Jokic isn't really a guy who's very offensively inclined when it comes to scoring, even though he does up his game in the playoffs. Like, in the regular season, he would rather scale back and become more of a facilitator and passer and playmaker. So I would be shocked if Jamal Murray doesn't lead the Nuggets in scoring over the next couple of years. And then, look, here we have Michael Porter Jr. coming along as well. This is going to give Jokic so many more options just to play off of. And I wouldn't even be shocked to see Jokic, as a result of this, average 10 assists in a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, it makes their hierarchy work. And it goes back to the point that we were talking about with Embiid in particular, but just like, can you win with a center as your best player? It's hard, but the answer is yes, if you have a star wing scorer. And Jamal Murray, I mean, look, he's not going to stay like this. I mean,
of course not.
47, 8, and 7 on 64% shooting. Like, that is not sustainable. But if this version of Jamal Murray, this aggressive version of Jamal Murray, who can create shots for himself off the dribble, like, I mean, he has just been pulling up, like, staring down Donovan Mitchell and just pulling up draining shots off the dribble. If that is here to stay,
right,
then Jokic could still be their best player on paper, but a Jamal Murray can be, you know, this takeover scorer complement that he needs in the playoffs. And then Michael Porter Jr. is still the wild card, but, you know, like, in theory, his two-way upside, he might be their best player on the team overall, like, long term. So, yeah, I mean, to your point about the Nuggets' future, yes, like, this is what they needed to see, regardless of what happens in Game 7. Of course, they're going to want to advance, but even if they lose, they can go home feeling really good about their future, I think.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Can we also just mention the fact that this is the second year in a row where we have one of those all-time great series involving the Nuggets? The Nuggets are just fun in the playoffs.
Yeah. Yeah, they should just always be. I mean, I'm curious to see what happens regardless of which team advances here, because I can't help but think that whichever team advances, the Clippers might have an easier time dispatching than they did with the Mavericks.
Yeah.
I just think matchup-wise, neither necessarily matches up well with the Clippers, especially if Pat Bev comes back.
Right.
So, like, regardless of which team wins this series, this could be the highlight of both team seasons. But that said, I mean, I think really both teams going into Game 7 should feel very good about themselves, not just now, but moving forward. Like, the Nuggets we've already addressed, but, I mean, again, like, Donovan Mitchell, Jamal Murray's getting all the attention right now because of what he's done lately, but Donovan Mitchell has 250 burgers in this series. He's averaging 38 points on nearly 55% shooting, 55.4 from deep. He's been sensational. You know, to be in this close of a series without Bojan Bogdanović, who was their number two scorer throughout the entire season, is remarkable. And I mean, they're doing it. It's really a four-man attack. It's Mitchell, Clarkson, Conley, and Gobert. And then Ingles is not really providing, you know, 9.5 points per game. Like, that's good, that's fine, but it's not, like, noteworthy. It's really, it's a top-heavy attack, but it's worked. You know, it got into a Game 7.
I mean, here we are. You're right. You're absolutely right. Mitchell, for this series, has played 221 minutes, and he scored 232 points. That's just outrageous. And yeah, look, I don't know what I can say more about Donovan Mitchell. I was always a fan. But even this is even, you know, blowing every expectation I ever had for him. I mean, he's becoming a superstar now. And I realize I'm throwing this word around with Jimmy and Donovan, but it's true.
I was just going to say, if you can do this in the playoffs, that is what makes you a superstar. Like,
right.
I agree. We're using that word a lot, but I think that's just because we did it with Tatum too. But, like, that's just because there's a lot of incredibly good young talent in the NBA where you could see this upside. And it's like, yeah, these guys, if they continue on this trajectory, they are the next generation of superstars.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I brought this up so many times, but the league is in such good hands. We really have a wide field of, you know, potential top tier superstars in just a couple years. I mean, look at that field. Jason Tatum, as you said, Donovan Mitchell, you know, Jamal Murray potentially, if he this, like you said, this is not sustainable, but what if it becomes more than we think? Like, maybe you and I are sitting here thinking, oh, when he returns next season, he's going to score 23 points a game and he's going to be more reliable and that's sort of it. What if he just completely explodes next season, averages 27 a game, is a highly efficient shooter, like living up to that 45% from downtown, you know, ideology that people had of him, and improves his defense, becomes like a legitimate secondary playmaker, then you have to throw him into the discussion. Like, Jimmy's probably mm-hmm. still not declining next year, so he's there. There's so many guys. Giannis is still there. Luka's only going to get better. You know, Ja Morant is on the horizon. Zion Williamson is there. This league, man, it's in such great hands. I love it. And then Trump and his nobody watches the NBA anymore tweet can go utter F itself.
Yeah. So, gun to your head, if you had to pick a winner of this game, who do you think moves on
Denver
to get executed?
Denver.
Yeah. I do too. Why do you?
Just the offensive firepower that they have from multiple positions. I think, you know, at the end of the day, whoever puts up the most points wins the game, and I think they have that potential.
Yeah, I think the return of Gary Harris is low-key a big difference maker for them too. Again, didn't do much off the bench in game six, only 4 points, but, you know, just having that secondary threat defensively, especially. I mean, it's just
right.
Another guy that you can throw at Mitchell and Clarkson. And then, yeah, as you said, I mean, Michael Porter Jr. is looming. Like, he only had 2 points in that game, but he's looming as a threat to go off at any time.
Right.
Maybe we get one more vintage Paul Millsap game before he goes off into retirement.
That would be nice. Just one more, because yeah. He looks ready for the retirement, doesn't he?
Yeah, we're gonna put him out to pasture soon. But, yeah. I mean, I'm hoping for – I mean, honestly, I'm just hoping for more Murray and Mitchell fireworks. Like, that's it would be fitting if both of these guys go down guns blazing. So I'm expecting a good one here.
I just want to read one stat before we move on. Now, he's already good at protecting the ball, but Monte Morris, in 155 minutes, has 4 turnovers.
He can never play for the Sixers.
No. Oh, but I mean, that's just impressive, right? And this is even playoff basketball.
It's incredible.
My God. I mean, this dude might, we should like put a pin in that. We should follow Monte Morris's career very, very intensely in terms of, will he be one of those guys when everything is said and done, who's, you know, one of the best in league history at just protecting the basketball? Because I think he might be.
Yeah, or like, does he have like a career assist to turnover ratio that just like blows everything out of the water?
Right, exactly. And of course, I realized that Jokic is point center, so that like flips the narrative a little bit. But oh boy, he's really good. But yeah, let's go to the other round. Let's go for it.
Yeah. So, Rockets Thunder, Game 5, Russ Westbrook comes back, the Rockets annihilate the Thunder, it looks like that is all she wrote. Game 6, we get bad Russ, we get very bad Russ, 7 turnovers, including a couple of costly miscues late. Meanwhile, Chris Paul, who the Rockets famously traded for Russell Westbrook, along with a ton of draft compensation, 28 points on 10 of 20 shooting, 7 rebounds, 3 assists, 3 steals, 0 turnovers. Danilo Gallinari also got hot, 25 points. You got some stuff from 10 points from SGA, 13 from Lou Dort, that was nice to see, 12 from Schroeder on 16 shots, yikes, but
it's pretty necessary for Lou
game
Dort.
7.
Yeah.
So, what are the big factors you're keeping an eye on heading into this game?
Well, again, that Dort doesn't have another game 5, where I don't even remember his line. We were covering that live on TV2, and we were just flabbergasted. I had the Danish commentator team in my ears, and I could talk to them during breaks and whatnot. and hear their interactions, and they're like, what is going on here? Like, why is he getting all those shots? Doesn't make sense. No, but that's part of it. It's a good question. I think for Oklahoma City, you kind of need to just keep what you're doing, right? So on some level, I don't even think they should be here, but they are. So whatever they've done has worked. I didn't anticipate this. I thought they would be out a little bit quicker. And here they are fighting in a game seven. So I think the bigger question is, should the ball just be given to James Harden and then basically, you know, ask him to go get 50, 55? Maybe that's the type of performance mm-hmm. that's needed. I don't know.
Yeah. Were you like most of Twitter wondering, especially in those late game possessions in game six? I mean, why was Russ the one handling the ball instead of James Harden?
You know me, so you know my question, my answer to that. Yes. were you waiting for some type of analysis on me on that one? Because look, it's really simple. You give the ball to the best player.
No, I mean, it's a super evenly matched series. I think, you know, the Thunder have not shied away from rolling out Steven Adams, some combination of Steven Adams and Nerlens Noel. They haven't really committed to the small ball lineups all that much, but it wouldn't totally shock me if we get into crunch time here, if they do trot out more Danilo at the five. I mean, ultimately, I think it is going to come down to Chris Paul versus James Harden more than Chris Paul versus Russell Westbrook. I think Chris Paul is very clearly intent on destroying the Rockets and making them regret ever giving up on him. And he is just going to be, you know, this has been the hallmark of him his whole career. He's very steady-handed. You don't have to worry about him, unlike Russ, making a ton of boneheaded mistakes. I think Russ is going to, you know this narrative is floating out there as well. So I think heading into game seven, he's going to look to kind of make his imprint early. And that could either go really well for the Rockets or it could go really poorly. And I'm not sure if there's a middle ground. So like heading into seven. Yeah. So like heading in, that is what I'm looking for in the first 5 minutes. Which version of Russell Westbrook do we get? Because I think that could go a long way in determining, which team advances.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I would not. I would probably use Westbrook more in a way as a secondary type of guy. I know that's not reasonable for Russ in Russ's view because he needs to come out, guns blazing, and that's been his style forever. But the Rockets are not going to be satisfied with a first round loss here. Could you imagine mm-hmm. the upheaval in Houston if this happens? Like, this would be the perfect excuse for Tillman Fertitta to blow everything up. So I think mm-hmm. this is a game, if the Rockets want to keep being competitive for the next couple of years, this is a game where Mike D'Antoni and Daryl Morey has to agree on initially and go, yeah, let's just not get the ball to Russ before before James has established himself. Just let's make sure this is James's game. What I'm worried about if I'm the Rockets, though, outside of Westbrook, is can I even trust Eric Gordon to make a damn three-pointer at this point?
Yeah, I mean, one of six from three in game six. He had 9 points on 3 of 12 shooting overall. You know, Covington was good with 18 points, 7-11 shooting, 4 of 6 from three, but Chris Paul was repeatedly picking on him and Jeff Green late in that game. That's another thing. If you're the Rockets, like, do you stick with switching everything or do you try to make sure that whoever's guarding Chris Paul stays on Chris Paul regardless of, you know, any potential switching? Because anytime he got switched up on one of those bigger guys, he was just dribble, 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 pull up for the mid-range and drilled every time. Or, conversely, do you bank on, like, okay, that is, efficiency-wise, not a great shot. Let's see if he can hit a couple of those before we change up anything. You dare him to make a couple of those.
No, you don't. You don't because, look, yes, you're right. Statistically speaking, it's not a great shot. But statistically speaking for Chris Paul, That's a good shot. There's a difference here, and we need to be able to separate it. Chris Paul, look, I'm going to try to be as delicate as I can be when I say this, okay? When Chris Paul is switched onto a center, he gets a semi, and there she goes. I mean, that's the way it is. We've seen this repeatedly in playoff context as well. It's just a couple of dribbles between the legs. It's a small step back. And then it's the jumper that goes cleanly through. He loves it. He loves the switches. So I would agree with you. You basically glue someone to his ass and hope it works.
And I'm also wondering, too, I mean, the narrative weight that you alluded to, you know, the Rockets know Mike D'Antoni's in the final year of his contract. Daryl Morey's future remains somewhat up in the air. Who knows what, you know, if they get knocked out in the first round, especially given all the controversy from the fall and, like, you know, if they get knocked out and, like, you know, his gamble on small ball didn't work out, Fertitta might decide, okay, let's go back to being more of a conventional team. So there's a lot of weight riding on the Rockets' shoulders, whereas the Thunder are playing with house money at this point. No one even expected them to be in the playoffs, much less in a Game 7. You know, again, I think the tricky thing will be for Chris Paul to manage that versus the revenge that he clearly wants to seek out on the Rockets, and then also the fair or unfair narrative that he chokes in big moments in the playoffs. So there's a lot of narrative working on both sides here.
I never really bought into, like, the choking thing. I made some jokes about it in the past, but it's always been tongue-in-cheek because there's and understand what I'm saying here. There's only so much you can do when you're barely 6 foot tall. You know what I mean? I mean, offensively, yeah, you can try to carry a team, but you are not capable of getting the same caliber of shots as someone as Kevin Durant, who's 6'12", I mean, who can just shoot over top of the defense like that? It's just not going to be the same looks. So, I think fans are being harsh on Chris for, you know, his playoff resume because he's doing what he can. I don't think we can ask of any more. For this game in particular, I just want him to do whatever he's been doing because it's worked. Like, I don't really want to see them change it up. Now, my question to you is, do you really think that people would look at this as a failure on behalf of the Rockets and their small ball evolution just because they lose in the first round? Is that the primary reason that they would lose against the Thunder, you think?
Yeah, it's a fair question. Not necessarily.
Right.
I mean, like, Steven Adams had 14 rebounds in Game 6, so, like, you can point at that. I think smart people realize there is nuance to this.
Right.
But unfortunately, smart people aren't the one driving a lot of the discourse around sports, especially on television.
Right.
So would it be reductive to blame small ball for their first-round exit? Yes. There are a number of reasons. Russell Westbrook missing the first four games, him being out of control in Game 6, Eric Gordon, as you said, not being able to hit a three all of a sudden.
Right.
But would that stop Skip Bayless or Stephen A. Smith or one of those people, Kendrick Perkins, from going on TV and saying you need to fire Daryl Morey, fire Mike D'Antoni because they made this gamble? Absolutely not.
That's going to be a narrative.
You know, I think, yeah, and I think, I don't know necessarily that Fertitta is one of these owners, but I do think a lot of owners in the NBA are swayed by public perception. So I think if that snowballs and becomes the narrative, the conventional narrative around this team, then I do think that could lead to some upheaval. But at the same time, like, they're kind of stuck. I don't know how you make drastic changes to this roster.
No. Yeah, what could that be? Trade Covington for an expiring contract just to get out of that at least? You probably can't.
To trade Russ. Like, I think that's the way out.
But who would want him?
Right. That's the question. I mean, I think it would be like similar to a Sixers Al Horford trade. Maybe just trade Al Horford for Russell Westbrook.
Oh, God. Yeah, I mean, if that happens, that's an open invitation for you to just leave that. Could you imagine next year's lineup? Russ and Ben Simmons fighting for the ball with Jason Kidd on the sideline. Oh, God. Oh. That would be brutal. That would be utter brutal. I could see that. Well, not specifically the Horford thing. I think they would be looking for, you know, expiring contracts. But no, you're right. This is the perfect opportunity for Fucita just to somehow blow it up. I mean, look, Harden will have trade value. Like he can get moved like that.
Yeah,
that's not the problem. Maybe that's enough for him. Maybe, yeah. I mean, no. Well, look, I'm not saying it's going to happen. What I'm saying is that I don't trust Tillman Fertitta. There we go. To any extent, to the point where this might actually end up being Harden's last season, not by his own determination, but because they have an owner who is in depth and is not doing things very well.
I'm not willing to go that far. Well, I mean, not about Fertitta, but I don't think he's going to trade Harden. But will they have buyer's remorse on Russell Westbrook if Chris Paul in particular knocks him out of the playoffs? I don't see how they wouldn't. And could that lead to some overreaction? Definitely. But I mean, I think Harden is probably all but untouchable unless, like, I can't even imagine the package a team would have to offer to get James Harden this offseason.
Well, he should be untouchable. He should be.
Right.
But if an owner has decided, nah, because, you know, the contract is too much or whatever, no, it doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to have a logic explanation.
That's true.
Like,
no, I think. So I was just going to say, I think if anything, like if you're looking ahead to some bigger changes, whether you're the Rockets or whoever, I think the time to do it is next offseason rather than this offseason, just because so few teams have cap room this year. So there's not going to be a scramble for big superstars in free agency.
Right.
Next year, if Giannis does become a free agent, you know, if something goes south in LA, LeBron becomes a free agent, or Kawhi or Paul George become free agents, or even if they don't, you still have guys like Oladipo and Drew Holiday and Rudy Gobert. So we could see a situation similar to what happened with Kawhi and Paul George this past summer, where a star says, I will sign here if you bring someone else in. And then you can extort a team and get, you know, like Paul George. Paul George alone would not have gotten the Thunder nearly as much as they did, but the Clippers gave up that much because they viewed it as Paul George plus Kawhi Leonard. So the Thunder, right. You know, were the beneficiaries of a ridiculously lopsided trade because they were only giving up half of the package, basically. So, right. You know, similar thing with this, and, you know, whether it's the Rockets with Harden or the Sixers with one of Simmons or Embiid, like, I could see them waiting until next offseason and then trying to strike if there is that kind of, you know, that clamoring for, I will sign here if you get a second star.
I love how you're, you know, attacking this from a point of logic and an observation. And you're really trying to think this through. And, you know, Daryl Morey would love you for it because I think he agrees.
Right.
I agree as well. I'm just stuck on the whole mindset that, you know, that's all fine and well, but if you have a trigger happy owner, that's not going to do you any good.
Yeah, no, it's true, and I mean you're right to bring up the financial concerns here because I do think that could be a storyline that could be the prevailing storyline of this offseason is like, are teams looking to shed salary and are they willing to give up on players they otherwise should not be because they cost too much money?
Some will be, undoubtedly.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's setting up to be a very pivotal Game 7, especially for the Rockets. So I'll ask again, if gun to your head, who are you going to take in this game?
I love individual player performances, so I'm going to go with Harden and thus the Houston Rockets.
I'm sticking with the Thunder just for hilarity's sake.
I look all good. I'll tell you what though, this is one of those series where I really don't care either way what happens. Like whoever moves
Yeah.
onwards, it's fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, I will say I think the Rockets would pose more of a challenge for the Lakers in the next round. So I think from an entertainment perspective, looking ahead for the rest of the playoffs, you should probably prefer the Rockets to advance. But from an entertainment perspective of people melting down on Twitter, you should prefer the Thunder to advance.
Right.
Right, well, that's a good place for us to wrap up. So we hope you guys enjoy the game sevens tonight and tomorrow. We will be back soon enough to talk some Western Conference semifinals, and then the East will still be going on as well. So we'll catch up with those series. In the meantime, please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bios to give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever else podcasts are found. On iTunes, please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We are being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined, as always, by Morten Jensen. Have a good one, Mort.
You too, Brian. Let's both not die.
Yeah, fingers crossed for you, buddy.
Thank you. Later.
Later.